Welcome everyone to today's custom tailored deep dive. We're really thrilled to have you with us.
Yeah, thanks for tuning in. We've got a great discussion lined up.
We really do. And today we're setting a scene that you will find incredibly relatable, even if you've, never actually picked up a metallurgy textbook in your life.
Right, because we rely on high-tech steel for absolutely everything around us.
Exactly. I mean, think about the aerospace industry. They have to engineer landing gear to withstand the massive sudden impact of a commercial jet touching down.
Hundreds of tons of metal just slamming onto a runway.
Yeah. Or think about advanced infrastructure, the suspension bridges that stay standing against hurricane force winds. We literally trust our lives to these materials every single day.
But we usually only see the finished product, right? The towering structures, the massive machines.
We rarely stop to think about the microscopic battlegrounds that actually give these metals their physical superpowers.
And that's exactly what we're looking at today. The real magic, the engineering that makes all of modern infrastructure possible, is happening at an atomic level.
Completely invisible to the naked eye.
Completely. And to explore that hidden world, we are digging into an incredibly detailed piece of source material. It's a foundational 1991 paper.
A classic.
Oh, absolutely, a landmark paper. It's titled, A Model for the Microstructure of Some Advanced Bainitic Steels, authored by M. Takahashi and HKDH Padacia.
And the reason this paper is so important, why we're doing a whole deep dive on it, is because it effectively bridges the gap between pure theoretical thermodynamics and practical industrial alloy design.
Yeah, it shows how the equations you write on a chalkboard actually dictate the way a piece of heavy steel behaves out in the real world.
Okay, let's unpack this. The core mission of our deep dive today is to explore exactly how metallurgists manipulate phase transformation theory. We want to understand how they design these advanced bainitic steels to push the absolute limits of strength and toughness.
But before we get to those superpowers, we should probably lay down some ground rules about what we're actually looking at under the microscope.
Good call. So in the realm of metallurgy, bainite is a specific type of microstructure. It forms in steel when you cool it from a red-hot state at a very specific rate.
And the paper immediately asks us to distinguish between two very distinct classes of bainite.
Right. So first, there is conventional bainite,
which is generally recognized as a non-lamellar mixture of ferrite and carbides. Essentially, you can think of it as a softer matrix of iron, and it's just peppered with these hard little carbon-rich particles.
The carbide.
Exactly. The carbides are precipitated all throughout it. But conventional bainite is not the focus of this paper.
No, it's not, nor is it the focus of our discussion today.
The real star of the show is the second class, carbide-free bainite.
Carbide-free. So in these specific highly engineered steels, there is a distinct time lag that occurs during the cooling and transformation process.
Right, the growth of the bainitic ferrite happens first, but the precipitation of those hard carbides we just mentioned, that lags far behind.
The lag is so significant, in fact, that the carbides simply don't form at all during that primary transformation window.
And because those carbides aren't forming, you're left with a uniquely dual-phase microstructure.
It consists solely of the bainitic ferrite plates and the leftover untransformed metal,
which metallurgists call the residual austenite.
Now, without the carbides forming, all that extra carbon has to go somewhere, right? It doesn't just vanish.
No, it definitely doesn't vanish. It gets rejected out of the newly formed ferrite and pushed directly into that residual austenite.
Just enriching it heavily with carbon.
Heavily. And that carbon enrichment leads us perfectly into the first major microscopic mystery presented in the text.
This part is so cool. It's a bizarre anomaly that the authors refer to as the incomplete reaction phenomenon.
Yeah, according to the experimental data in the paper, in these specific steels where no other reactions are interfering, the transformation from austenite into bainitic ferrite just snops.
It halts entirely. Well, before it reaches the maximum volume fraction you'd normally expect based on standard thermodynamic rules.
Normally, you'd expect a reaction to continue until it hits what is called the AE3 prime curve, or periquilibrium.
And periquilibrium is a fascinating concept on its own. It describes a state where the small carbon atoms are highly mobile. They can dart around and diffuse through the metal.
But the much larger iron atoms are basically frozen in place.
Right, unable to reconstruct their lattice. So you would expect the reaction to keep going until the carbon balances out in this frozen iron matrix. But it doesn't.
It doesn't. And what's fascinating here is exactly why this happens. The reaction actually stops at a very specific mathematical boundary known as the T0.
It's that T0.
Yeah. To visualize this, Imagine a phase diagram. It's basically a map showing what state the metal should be in at any given temperature and carbon concentration.
The T-Euro curve is the locus, the exact line on that map, where austenite and ferrite of the exact same chemical composition have identical free energies.
It's the thermodynamic tipping point. The metal has absolutely no preference between being austenite or being ferrite at that exact line.
But the paper introduces a massive physical twist to this thermodynamic map.
That's Rayman energy.
Exactly. When bainite grows, it doesn't just gently fade into existence. The transformation involves what the authors call an invariant plane strain shape deformation.
Which sounds incredibly complex.
It does. But to put that in plain English, the metal violently forces its way into a new crystal structure, physically shoving the surrounding atoms out of the way.
And that violent physical shoving creates a massive amount of internal tension, strain energy within the metal lattice.
We are talking about 400 joules per mole of energy just pent up inside the structure.
Because of this intense physical struggle, the thermodynamic rules actually change. You have to modify the T-Euro curve to account for that 400 joules of trapped energy.
Which creates a new, more restrictive boundary called the T0 prime curve.
Right.
And the fact that the reaction stops dead at this T0 prime curve proves something fundamental about how these metals form. It proves that bainitic ferrite grows without diffusion. It grows displacively.
Displacively, yeah.
So imagine trying to instantly build a house in a densely packed neighborhood where there are no empty lots. You have to physically shove the neighboring houses out of the way to make room.
That takes a massive amount of physical energy.
Exactly. That's your 400 joules of strain. Now, as you instantly build this house, you generate a ton of construction debris, which represents the excess carbon.
Right.
You don't have time to process it, so you just toss all that leftover carbon debris over the fence into the yard next door.
The yard being the residual austenite.
Yes. You keep instantly building these houses, displacing the neighborhood, and tossing the carbon debris into the adjacent yards.
Until eventually, the yard is completely full.
Mm-hmm.
The residual austenite becomes so heavily enriched with carbon that it hits that thermodynamic limit we just discussed.
The T0 prime curve.
Exactly. It becomes physically and thermodynamically impossible to toss any more debris over the fence. And because you cannot get rid of the carbon debris, you simply cannot build another house.
The transformation is forced to a grinding halt,
leaving you with an incomplete reaction.
Now, recognizing this theoretical limit is a massive breakthrough, but it's really only half the battle. Because if engineers want to predict the unseen and actually manufacture these advanced steels at a commercial scale, they need a specific recipe.
A recipe to ensure the neighborhood doesn't get ruined by other reactions.
Exactly. To make this carbide-free house-building scenario work, you have to add specific alloying elements to the steel. The paper notes you need elements like aluminum, silicon, or chromium.
These elements act as chemical roadblocks. They specifically retard the formation of cementite, which is the most common form of carbide in steel.
And this exact alloying recipe is used right now in commercial ultra-high-strength applications.
Oh, everywhere. The aerospace industry relies heavily on 300mm steel for landing gear, which is a material that utilizes this exact silicon-rich chemistry to achieve its strength.
The same principles are applied in austempered ductile cast irons used in heavy machinery and in advanced forging steels.
And the really impressive part is that the 1991 paper didn't just theorize this. They pointed to incredibly precise experimental data to validate the math behind the T0 curve.
They referenced work by Yusui and colleagues who used X-ray diffraction to measure the retained austenite in iron carbon silicon manganese alloys.
Right, because X-ray diffraction allows scientists to measure the lattice parameter,
which is essentially the physical distance between the atoms and the metal's crystal structure.
And because carbon atoms sit interstitially, meaning they literally squeeze into the empty spaces between the larger iron atoms, forcing more carbon into the austenite actually expands the physical size of the lattice.
Usui's team used a specific mathematical formula to measure exactly how much the lattice stretched. It was a gamma equals 0.3573 plus 0.000075 times x gamma, measured in nanometers.
And from that physical stretch, they could back calculate the precise concentration of carbon trapped inside that austenite yard.
And when they plotted those real-world carbon concentrations derived from the X-ray data, the numbers matched the theoretical predictions of the T-Euro curve flawlessly.
It proved that the thermodynamic model, strain energy and all, was actively dictating the physical stopping point of the reaction in the real world.
But thermodynamics only tells us where the reaction wants to stop. the paper then pivots to kinetics.
The study of time and rates.
Right. Because if you're running a massive steel mill, you don't have forever to wait for metal to transform. You are fighting the clock.
Furthermore, in a real industrial heat treatment facility, you aren't just holding a massive block of steel at one single temperature.
No, the metal is constantly cooling down as it moves through the line.
So engineers need a way to predict this complex dance, which brings us to TTT and CCT diagrams.
TTT stands for time temperature transformation. If you look at a classic TT diagram, it generally looks like two large C-shaped curves plotted on a graph of temperature versus time.
The higher temperature C curve represents reconstructive reactions. At these elevated temperatures, atoms have plenty of thermal energy to move around freely and completely reconstruct their crystal lattices,
leading to structures like perlite.
Exactly.
But looking at the model, that lower C curve is where our bainite lives. It represents displacive transformations. At these lower temperatures, the metal is too cold for atoms to casually diffuse over long distances.
Instead, the structure has to physically shear or deform into place, like the violent house building analogy we discussed earlier.
The authors adapted a model originally created by a scientist named Russell, his incubation time model, to calculate these specific curves. They modified Wessel's math to account for how the austenite becomes continuously enriched with carbon as the bainite reaction proceeds.
But that gives us a static model for a constant temperature. To bridge the gap to continuous cooling, which is the reality of a factory floor, the authors applied Shale's rule,
also known as the additivity principle.
Right. This is essentially a calculus-like approach to metallurgy. It provides a mathematical way to chop a continuous sloping cooling process into thousands of tiny, discrete isothermal steps.
By summing up the microscopic fractions of transformation that happen at each split-second temperature drop, engineers can convert that static TT2 diagram into a dynamic CCT diagram.
A continuous cooling transformation diagram.
Which is a literal roadmap for a steel mill. It allows an engineer to look at a cooling rate and predict the exact final microstructure of a massive steel component as it comes off the line.
Because inside that cooling process, there is a microscopic race happening that dictates everything about the final metal. The paper delves deep into the transition between upper and lower bainite, framing it as a high-stakes atomic drag race.
Let's talk about that race. On one track, you have the time it takes for the excess carbon to partition or diffuse out of the newly formed ferrite and escape into the residual austenite.
The paper designates this diffusion time as S subscript D.
On the competing track, you have the time it takes for that carbon to simply give up a stabing and precipitate into hard carbides right there inside the ferrite plate.
And they designate this precipitation time as T subscript C.
The winner of that race determines the fundamental physical properties of the metal you hold in your hand. If diffusion is faster, meaning TE wins the race, the carbon successfully escapes the ferrite entirely.
You get upper bainite.
Right. Which consists of those pristine carbide-free ferrite plates and the carbon-enriched austenite we've been aiming for.
However, if precipitation is faster and TC beats TED, the carbon gets trapped. It forms carbides inside the ferrite plates before it can reach the yard,
resulting in lower bainite. Here's where it gets really interesting. The paper calculates a specific magical threshold for this race.
Yeah, in plain carbon steels, the transition temperature between upper and lower bainite peaks right around 0.4 mass percent carbon.
It is an incredibly sharp dividing line. Below 0.4% carbon, the carbon is sparse enough that it almost always escapes. You basically only ever get upper bainite up until the temperature drops so drastically that the metal just shears into brittle martensite.
But the moment you cross above that 0.4% carbon threshold, precipitation starts winning the race.
And you are locked into lower bainite.
To prove this isn't just a quirky artifact of plain carbon steel, the authors mapped this transition model against experimental data gathered by another researcher named Pickering.
Pickering had meticulously documented the transformation temperatures of much more complex iron, molybdenum, manganese carbon alloys.
And the theoretical 0.4% threshold model aligned perfectly with Pickering's complex alloy data,
proving the thermodynamics hold true across vastly different chemical systems. Now, we have to address the role of silicon in this atomic race, because the paper highlights a detail about it that feels completely counterintuitive.
Yeah, we established earlier that silicon is the secret ingredient, the chemical roadblock that stops cementite from forming, allowing us to achieve that pure carbide-free upper bainite.
But the thermodynamic math reveals a strange contradiction in how silicon actually behaves at the atomic level.
When the authors ran their calculations, assuming peri-equilibrium growth, they confirmed that silicon does drastically slow down the overall growth rate of cementite.
It fundamentally disrupts the kinetics of the particle getting larger.
However, the exact same thermodynamic calculations revealed that silicon actually increases the maximum driving force, a metric they call Gmax, for the initial nucleation of cementite.
Thermodynamically, the cementite has an incredibly strong desire to be born, to nucleate into existence. The engine is redlining.
But because of the silicon roadblock, it physically cannot grow past that initial nucleation stage.
It's like sitting in a sports car with the accelerator pressed all the way to the floor, but the parking brake is pulled all the way up. The energy and the desire to move are immense, but the kinetics simply will not allow the vehicle to roll forward.
The particles are trapped in a state of extreme tension, unable to grow to a meaningful size.
So what does this all mean? We've talked about thermodynamic T0 curves, 400 joules of strain energy, atomic drag races, and silicon parking brakes. Bringing it back to you, the listener, why do we want this specific duplex microstructure of bainitic ferrite and residual austenite in the first place?
Why go through all this complex mathematical and chemical trouble?
Exactly.
Well, the structural benefits of achieving this specific state are absolutely massive for industrial applications.
When you successfully navigate the cooling process to get this carbide-free microstructure, you are creating an intimate dispersion of ductile austenite films directly between the hard ferrite plates.
And these austenite films have a face-centered cubic, or FCC, crystal structure.
The FCC structure is crucial because of how its atoms are arranged. They are packed in a way that creates natural slip planes, allowing microscopic layers of the metal to slide over one another without breaking the atomic bonds.
This inherent ability to slide makes FCC metals highly ductile. These tiny microscopic films of austenite act like built-in atomic shock absorbers dispersed evenly throughout the hard steel matrix.
If a microscopic crack forms from fatigue and tries to propagate through the metal, it eventually hits one of these soft, ductile austenite films.
And the sharp cutting edge of the crack tip gets blunted by the sliding atoms, and its destructive energy harmlessly dissipates.
But the defense mechanisms get even more sophisticated than simple blunting. The paper highlights a phenomenon known as the TIRP effect,
which stands for transformation-induced plasticity. It's one of the most elegant self-healing defense mechanisms in material science.
When a crack is propagating through a piece of steel, it pushes a massive concentrated stress field ahead of it.
As that invisible wave of intense physical pressure hits these ductile austenite films, the sheer mechanical force actually causes the austenite to undergo a sudden, localized phase transformation into martensite.
The metal physically changes its state right in front of the advancing crack, acting like a dynamic shield.
The act of undergoing that intense phase transformation absorbs a tremendous amount of the fracture energy. The crack literally exhausts itself, trying to force the surrounding metal to change crystal structures.
And beyond stopping cracks, the paper notes that hydrogen diffuses very sluggishly through an austenite lattice.
Having these films dispersed everywhere acts as an impenetrable labyrinth for hydrogen atoms. It significantly enhances the steel's resistance to hydrogen embrittlement and stress corrosion cracking in harsh environments.
The most remarkable aspect for the industry is that they achieve all these super advanced properties primarily using carbon.
It is the cheapest, most abundant austenite stabilizer available on the planet. You don't need to mine exotic, incredibly expensive rare earth metals to achieve aerospace-grade toughness.
You just need a brilliant, mathematically modeled heat treatment process and a calculated addition of silicon.
This raises an important question, though. If this carbide-free bainite is such a flawless, self-healing supermaterial, why does it ever fail in the field?
The authors are very transparent about the flaw in the armor, and it entirely comes down to microscopic geometry.
We've been praising the virtues of these ultra-thin films of austenite trapped tightly between the ferrite plates. But during a real-world transformation, the cooling process isn't always perfect.
Sometimes you end up with much larger, chunkier regions of residual austenite that get trapped between the larger sheaves of bainite. The authors refer to this undesirable geometry as blocky austenite.
The thin films are incredibly stable because of their geometry. They have a massive concentration of carbon squeezed into a tiny space, and they are physically constrained.
They are held in a microscopic vice grip by the surrounding ferrite plates, which prevents them from transforming prematurely.
But those large, unconstrained blocks lack that physical vice grip. They are highly unstable.
Under even relatively minor amounts of everyday mechanical stress, those large, unstable blocks of austenite will spontaneously transform.
But because they lack the geometric constraint of the films, they transform into high-carbon, untempered martensite.
Untempered martensite is essentially the microscopic equivalent of glass. It is incredibly hard, but it shatters under pressure.
Instead of acting like a dynamic shock absorber to blunt a crack, these blocky regions turn into microscopic glass shards embedded throughout your steel component.
When a crack hits one of these untempered martensite blocks, it shatters, severely embrittling the entire structure and completely negating the toughness you worked so hard to achieve with the Tree 5 effect.
The ultimate challenge for the metallurgist, and the reason these mathematical cooling models are so vital, is designing a process that maximizes the thin films while eliminating the blocky austenite entirely.
So to recap the incredible atomic journey we've been on today, we started with the mystery of the incomplete reaction, learning how 400 joules of physical strain energy shoves metal atoms aside to create the T0 prime curve, stopping the diffusionless growth of bainite dead in its tracks.
We explored how engineers use X-ray diffraction to measure stretching lattices to validate their math.
And how they utilize Shale's rule to chop continuous cooling into thousands of steps to predict industrial outcomes. We watched the high-stakes atomic drag race between carbon diffusion and cementite precipitation, pivoting on that crucial 0.4% carbon threshold.
All while the silicon parking brake prevented the cementite from growing.
Finally, we uncovered the crack-blunting, shape-shifting superpowers of the trip effect while acknowledging the fatal glass-like Achilles heel of blocky austenite. The next time you fly in a commercial plane or drive heavy machinery over a suspension bridge, remember, there's a very good chance this exact microscopic dance of phase transformations is happening all around you, keeping you safe.
It alters the way you look at the built environment. Before we close, I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over, expanding on the core principles of this paper. We just discussed how sheer physical constraint, the geometry of being squeezed tightly as a microscope film in a vice grip of ferrite plates, is enough to make an otherwise highly unstable phase of metal completely stable and useful. If that principle of geometric constraint holds true in advanced steels, could we apply this concept of geometrical trapping to entirely different fields of science? Could we engineer synthetic nanostructures in advanced polymers or ultra-lightweight ceramics or even the solid-state batteries powering the next generation of electric vehicles, where unstable high-energy states are kept permanently frozen and usable simply by the physical architecture we build around them?
Wow.
It's a fascinating avenue for future material design that builds directly on the legacy of this 1991 paper.
What a phenomenal concept to carry with us. Thank you so much for joining us on this custom-tailored deep dive today. Keep wondering, keep observing the hidden mechanics of the world around you, and keep asking those big questions. We'll catch you next time.